And I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Dr. Imri Banga from the Oriental Institute here, who's the lecturer in Hindi. I'm sure he's familiar to you all. He's done work on early Hindi poetry and the emergence of Hindi as a literary language. And he's going to share the results of some of his work with us today in a lecture entitled The Roots of Early Hindi Literary Culture.
Yeah. thanks, Gavin. And well, it's a privilege to give the Domaszewski lecture here at the Oriental Institute. Probably I am the person who had to walk the least for this talk, since my office is just in front. I'm going to talk about one of my favorite themes, about how Hindi literature began, if it began at all, or if we can use the terms Hindi and beginning in the context of literature. Now, I want to draw your attention to some recent literature about the genesis of literature in a language. And when I went to school, I was taught very much in a Herderian fashion that the literatures began as oral literatures, and then at some point in history they would be committed to writing, and there is no substantial difference between the initial oral literature and when it has been committed to writing. That's why we can talk about oral literature as such, which would be a paradox otherwise. This Herderian view is very much framed in a nationalistic framework, that a literature would pop up somehow from the soil of the people, and then later high culture grows from it. Now, there has been some recent discussion about how Hindi literature began, and the seminal work is that of Sheldon Pollock, The Language of Gods in the World of Man, that was published seven years ago, 2006. And Sheldon Pollock distinguished written literature from oral literature, and rather used the term literary cultures. And his magnum opus, The Language of God, The Language of Gods, has been introduced by an edited volume where essays within a collaborative project were produced about most of the about most of the literary cultures in India. Sheldon Pollock talks about the vernacularization and the vernacular millennium, and how a and he is especially interested in how a literature begins, and points out clear phases when what we can call beginning, and also he would show the literature in a way that it grows, it becomes a flourishing literature, a literary culture, and then it declines. He is especially interested in the decline of Sanskrit and the vernacularization, how in the second millennium of the Common Era, Sanskrit gave way to various vernaculars. Sheldon Pollock says that the creation of a literature is a socio-political act, and it is done not from the soil, but rather from above, normally in a courtly environment. Also, he distinguishes phases in committing a language to writing. He says a language is first literarized, so it is committed to writing, not necessarily in literary documents, but rather in inscriptions, and then it is literarized when literature emerges in that language. He also shows that one of the driving forces of the emergence of vernacular literatures, one after another, in India, is cultural emulation, that I just see what my neighbor is doing, producing literature in the vernacular, so I also produce literary culture in the vernacular. Cultural emulation is a term that Sheldon Pollock borrows from archaeology and applies it to cultural studies. More recently, Alison Bush from Columbia University has published an article about Hindi literary beginnings, and she pinpoints the beginning of Hindi literature with Maulana Daud's Chandayan that was produced in 1379 of the Common Era. using very much the Pollockian framework that literatures, literary cultures have clear beginnings. In a recent article in 2012, Francesco Orsini from SOAS drew our attention to the fact that literatures in South Asia shouldn't be examined in isolation, but literatures come to be come to being in a multilingual environment. Already Sheldon Pollock and Alison Bush has drawn attention to multilinguality, but they still operated within the framework of language literatures. Right. Now, the traditional view of literatures in South Asia is complex, but there is one view in which somehow the linguistic development is projected down to the emergence of literatures. So there is old Indo-Aryan language and there is Sanskrit literature on it. Then there are the Middle Indo-Aryan languages in Prakrit and Upper Brahmsha languages. And in our case, which will lead to Hindi, it is the Shaurasena Prakrit and the Shaurasena Upper Brahmsha linguistically that is shown as the antecedents of Hindi, and then come new Indo-Aryan languages. In my talk, I'm going to question this tripartite linear development, and would like to draw your attention to the complexity of the emergence of a literary culture. This is very much a work in progress, so I will be very, very happy to receive your feedback on it. first of all, I would like to talk about how Hindi literature has been imagined within the colonialist and nationalist framework. And most of Hindi literature that is taught nowadays in India has been defined by that framework. There has been a search for the earliest Hindi works during the colonial and the nationalist periods. And, for example, the earliest Hindi literary history that can really be called literary history and not just a lexicon like some earlier works is Shiv Singh Sengar's Shiv Singh Saroj, who said that the poet Pushi at the court of King Mana around 1000 of the Common Era composed vernacular couplets, dohras, about Alankara Shastra. These dohras have disappeared since, and we don't know anything more about this poet Pushi, but this has this idea has been taken on by subsequent literary historians. The next substantial Hindi literary history was produced by the Mishra brothers. In Hindi they are called Mishra Bandhu, and their work is called the Mishra Bandhu Vinod, kind of the pastime or the entertainment of the Mishra brothers, which came out in 1913. And based on Rahul Sankratyayan's ideas, they said that the Nath yogis were the first to produce Hindi literature in the 10th and 12th centuries. Again, and as we see Hindi becoming more as a national language, there has been a need, a candidate for national language, there has been a need to project Hindi even back further in time, And Chandradar Sharma Guleri in 1948 declared that Apabhramsha is in fact early Hindi. If Anglo-Saxon literature can be part of English literature, why not Apabhramsha being part of Hindi literature? And like this, you would have Hindi literature of 1.5 millennia. The defining views on Hindi literature have been produced by Ramchand Shukla in 1929 in his Hindi Sahitya Ka Itihas, the history of Hindi literature, and at universities in India and in many other countries, it is still the views of Ramchand Shukla that get repeated about Hindi literature. Ramchand Shukla talked about three eras of Hindi literature: the initial era, the Adikal, which he also called the heroic era because it produced heroic songs according to Ramchand Shukla; the Madhyakal, the middle era, which he further divided into Bhaktikal and Ritikal; and then the Adhunikal, the modern era. Now I'm interested in the Adikal, about the initial era of Ramchand Shukla. And he defined Adikal between 1000 and sometime in the 14th century, so about 320-350 years were devoted to the Adikal, to the initial era. And he included two kinds of literatures within his initial era. That's Apabhramsha literature produced by Jains, Buddhist Siddhas, and also he considered Nath Yogis to produce Apabhramsha literature. And also he talked about vernacular Deshbhasha poetry, and there were two genres of vernacular poetry according to Ramchand Shukla. One was the Raso literature from Rajasthan, which is heroic poetry, from Rajasthan, and the earliest heroic poems he thought to date from the late 12th or the early 13th century. And also there were independent stray poems called Muktak in Hindi, or Muktaka in Sanskrit, which would come into his group of Deshbhasha poetry. Ramchand Shukla is probably the best expression of nationalist Hindi historiography. He tried to, well, he included Apabhramsha into his literary history. also he talked about Hindi as broad as possible geographically, including the borderlands of Mithila and of Rajasthan within Hindi literature. I will examine Ramchand Shukla's views more in detail. Ramchand Shukla didn't directly identify Apabhramsha with Hindi as did Guleri 20 years later. However, implicitly, by including it into his history of Hindi literature, he wanted to present the Hindi literature of 1,500 years. Another example of nationalist Hindi historiography is the Hindi Sahitya Ka Brihat Itihas, of which the Adikal volume came out in 1983. This is a 16-volume history of Hindi literature, probably the largest literary histories of any South Asian language. And Adikal, the initial era, has received one volume in it. In this volume, Apabhramsha is still discussed as Hindi literature as well as oral literature, so very much the paradigm that we have seen in Ramchand Shukla, the Deshbhasha poetry, but here it is called oral literature, not claimed to have been written down as has been done by Ramchand Shukla. There are problems with this Adikal, but the term has been very firmly embedded into Hindi literary history, that there has been an Adikal, an initial era of Hindi literature. One problem is the continuity of Apabhramsha and Hindi. And people like to, the advocates of this continuity like to cite verses which look very much like modern Hindi taken from Apabhramsha poetry. And one example which is which has been quoted tremendously since it has been discovered is from Hemachandra's Shabdanushasana. So it's a 12th century text, and it reads as Bhalla Huajo Maria Bahini Mahara Kantu, which in modern Hindi would be something like Bhala Huajo Mara Gaya Bahen Mera Kant. And you see the English translation, it's good, my sister, that my husband has been was killed. Well, it is going to be explained why. It's the heroic era. The second line, however, has nothing to do with modern Hindi. It's just a great Apabhramsha. Lajje jantu vayansi ayu jai bhagga gari aintu. I would have been put to shame among my friends if he had run away from the battle and come home. The problem with identifying Hindi and Apabhramsha is that you can pick up certain sentences which look very similar, but when you see longer works, then you would end up seeing really the dissimilarity of the two languages. I'm going to talk about the terminology later. At first, I would like to survey what has been produced in India about the initial times in Hindi literature. So, in a way, Apabhramsha and cannot really be perceived to be Hindi, as no modern Hindi speaker would be able to understand or to make anything out of an Apabhramsha line like this. We come to the Nat songs, claimed to be also part of early Hindi, dating from the 10th to the 12th century. Here we have got a modern image of Goraknath. These are yogic. These are songs mostly with about yogic practices, quite often in Sandhya Bhasha, encoded language. And there are problems also with the Nath songs. Well, many of them, many of these songs have modern features, and also no manuscript. And this is the most important thing: no manuscript prior to the 17th century. The earliest manuscript of the Gorakh Bani dates from 1614, the earliest dated manuscript of the Gorakh Bani. And we can very much conjecture that these songs have been transmitted orally and updated to the language use of the time and the place they were sung. So even if they might have preserved very early features close to Apabhramsha, they mix them very much with modern features, and considering them to be part of an early literary culture would be a too far-fledged argument. They have been transmitted orally, and they might even be the productions of the 16th or 17th century, and some of them maybe may go back very much to earlier antecedents, and some of them may even go back to Apabhramsha antecedents. But philologically, they cannot be reconstructed as early Hindi literature prior to the Mughal era. Now, the Raso works. These are heroic narratives, mostly from Rajasthan. There are two kind of Raso works. One is like Visaradeva Rasa, which is about a woman pining for the husband who has gone away, probably on a military expedition. And the other one is is about description of battles. And the most famous Raso work, which has long been perceived to be the earliest Raso work and the earliest work in Hindi literature is the Prithviraj Rasu. And that literary historians claimed Prithviraj Rasu to date from the times of Prithviraj, and they attributed to Prithviraj's court poet Chand Bardai. Prithviraj has long exercised influence over Indian imagination as a kind of early freedom fighter who fought the intruding Muslims. However, quite a lot of influential Hindi scholars questioned the early dates attributed to the Rasu works, and those who are familiar with Hindi literary history might know the names of Gauri Shankar Hirachand Ojha, Motilal Menaria, and Hazari Prasad Dwivedi. The first two are Rajasthani historians, and Hazari Prasad Dwivedi is a historian of early Hindi. These scholars point out that Rasu works have either disappeared or come from a much later period. So in some Rasu works you would even find guns and gunpowder. You can always argue that it's later interpolation, but no manuscript evidence from prior the Mughal era for any Rasu work. Now, this is what I have been talking about, has been very much reiterating what recent secondary literature has been talking about. Another claimant for early Hindi is Vidyapati from Mithila, so that's northern Bihar. Mithila hasn't been very much part of Hindi manuscript circulation, and Vidyapati hasn't been included into Hindi literary history or early Hindi literary histories before the nationalist era. He was much more part of an independent Maithili culture, or Bengalis have expressed their admiration for Vidyapati much more than people in the Hindi belt. And when we see Vidyapati in manuscripts, we have early manuscripts from the 16th century onward. But the manuscripts come either from Nepal or from Mithila or from Bengal, and not really from the Hindi heartland. also, Vidyapati would come after the proposed Adikal initial era of Ramchand Shukla. Now, another claimant is Amir Khusro. Amir Khusro has been a historical figure who has produced excellent works in Indo-Persian, and he has long been the only Indo-Persian poet whom Iranians have appreciated. While his Persian works cannot be questioned, they are authentic, he also mentioned in one of his works that he has composed Hindi songs or Hindavi songs, but he didn't want to commit them to writing. He was quite dismissive of writing down Hindi as not a language of prestige, and from this we can have an insight into the working of languages of prestige, that normally we can suspect that languages of prestige have been committed to writing, especially at the very early times when paper have not spread over India and material for writing was very expensive, or relatively expensive, let's put like this. Now, so Hindi compositions attributed to Amir Khusro survive only from 17th century or later manuscripts. And here I would like to draw your attention to one of the compositions of Amir Khusro, or attributed to Amir Khusro. This is a beautiful Rekhda composition, a bilingual composition. The first half of these lines are in Persian. Zihale miskin makunta gaful, durae nenan, banae batyan, And again, the first light half is in Persian. Kitab-e Hijran, Nadaram Ejan, Nalehu Kahe Lagae Chatiyam. And then here, one line in Persian and one line in Brijbhasha. That's the last line. Bahakke Anruz Ifazli Makhshar Kidade Mara Fareba Khusrau Samipa Manake Davari Rakhun Jopa Jojane Paun Paraya Rakhya. This poem with the takhallus, the poetic signature of Amir Khusro that is included into the at the end, survived in manuscripts that date first in 1719, and in later manuscripts you get the takhallus Khusro. So it's 18th century. An interesting discovery has been made by Mahmood Sherani, a famous Pakistani scholar of early Urdu. He has found the same song in a bayaz, in a handwritten book, which dates from 1652, between 1652 and 56. And there, the last two lines are different. And in the last but one line, the takhallus is Jafar, another poet. We don't know anything about Jafar, and Mahmood Sherani and Urdu scholarship hasn't been able to point out who Jafar was. But what seems to be very likely is that the composition by an unknown poet becomes attributed to a very well-known poet, namely Amir Khusro. Now, this Zihale Miskin Rehta is so well attached to the name of Amir Khusro that any Qawwali singer would become very angry with me if I had told him that the authorship of Amir Khusro can be questioned. And similarly, with the other compositions that have been mentioned here, you cannot find early manuscripts, and sometimes you would be able to find more or less the same composition attributed to other poets, especially with the Muktakas. Now, coming to my hypothesis, which is very much a hypothetical history of early Hindi, I would like to talk about a few terms that need clarification. So when I talk about literature, I talk about literary culture and not oral literature, as I have mentioned it earlier. But important things are language, which is a modern construction, and we have dialects, and in North India we have a language area or a dialect continuum where dialects from Punjab or further to the west are continuous to Assam, and you have to impose languages above the spoken dialects. So people on two parts of the border, of the Bihar-Bengal border, would be called Hindi speakers in Bihar and Bengali speakers in Bengal, but their dialects would hardly be different from each other. The same about Punjabi and, let us say, Haryanvi, that Haryana people are supposed to talk in Hindi, but the village language is a continuum towards Punjabi, and the same towards Gujarat and towards the other new Indo-Aryan languages in the north. So, and when I talk about dialect, I would like to distinguish a dialect which is very much a spoken phenomenon from a literary idiom. And the literary idiom can be called a literary language, which is very much a written the idiom of an oral literature, but it is normally composite of elements from various spoken dialects. It can be a literary idiom can be localized, but quite often non-local elements pop up in early literary idioms. So their localization is not so direct as that of a dialect. And literary idioms grow. In Sheldon Pollock's terminology, vernacular literary idioms become cosmopolitan vernaculars when a vernacular is used far away from the field to which it has initially been localized. So, for example, Brajbhasha used in the Deccan or Brajbhasha used in Punjab or in Gujarat would be a cosmopolitan vernacular that transcends the boundaries of the modern spoken dialect. And those who go to Braj and observe the modern dialect of Braj will see that the literary dialect, the Brajbhasha, is quite different from the modern spoken Brajbhasha dialect. And then I come to the most problematic term, Hindi. Well, what is Hindi? Eventually it can be an endless debate what to consider Hindi. What you can see is that Hindi can be perceived to be a modern construct. So 19th century colonial and then nationalist construction of putting together several literary idioms and and calling all of them Hindi. That is one view. However, I would like to draw your attention to the fact that Hindi in the 18th century and prior referred much more to Urdu than to Hindi. It is strange, but the term Hindi just means Indian. And it happens to us when we tell to lame people that we work on India, then I get the question, and do you speak Indian? And this is how maybe 1,000 years ago Arab or Persian speakers just perceived the language of India to be Hindi. And Hindi has been a term over that the meaning of which was changing over the centuries and hasn't been very clearly defined before the 19th century. However, I would like to stress that there has been a Hindi literary consciousness in which works in various literary idioms kind of interacted with each other. So modern Hindi would include the early modern literary idioms of Brajbhasha, Avadhi, Sadhukkari, which is a mixed language of wandering sadhus, and also Kari Boli. All these terms date from no earlier than the 17th century. And earlier, the language was just called Bhasha, vernacular, or if it was contrasted with Sanskrit, or Hindi, if it was contrasted with Persian, the language of India. And in contrast, or it was also called by some localized names. For example, Purabi was the name of Avadhi, and Dakkani was the name of Kari Boli used in the Deccan. So why can we talk about Hindi or old Hindi? As a group term for various literary idioms. One thing is that quite often the works produced in one literary idiom of Hindi circulated also in another literary idiom. So, for example, early 17th century author Bajid produced works in Dundari, which is a dialect, which is the dialect around Jaipur. And his works circulated both in Dundari and in Brajbhasha. Or the best example would be Tulsidas, who starts his career as an Awadhi author. He authors songs about the wedding of Sita and Rama, and about the wedding of Shiva and Parvati, and even about the nail pairing of Rama in Awadhi, and he produces his magnum opus, the Ramcharitmanas, in Awadhi. But by the time he finishes it, in the 1570s or 1580s maybe, Brajbhasha becomes the overwhelmingly accepted literary idiom for vernacular authors, and he shifts to Brajbhasha, and he reproduces the Rama narrative in various Brajbhasha forms, in Barves, in Kavitsaveyas, also in Padas, which are the favorite forms of the Braj Krishna Bhakta authors. And you can also see that Tulsidas is part of the Brajbhasha literary universe. And it is not because of his later Brajbhasha works, but because of his Awadhi work. So somehow there was an a pre-colonial consciousness that works produced in Brajbhasha and Awadhi somehow belong together. And further than that, works produced in Sadhukkari, which is the mixed language of the sadhus, it's a modern term coined in the 20th century to name the language of Kabir, are interspersed with works in Brajbhasha, in manuscripts. So these literary idioms somehow were closely joined together. However, I have to mention that sometimes literary idioms that became part of later languages were also joined together. For example, in the Guru Granth Sahib, Punjabi and Hindi would be used together, but not distinguished in early modern times as such as Punjabi, and this is in Brajbhasha, or this is in Sadhukkari. My point is that we can talk about Hindi in early modern context as about Hindi literature as part of a shared literary consciousness that was present at Mughal times, at least, and which is an umbrella work for various literary idioms. Now, here comes what I really want to talk about is Maru Gurjar literature, which is claimed today by both Gujarati and Rajasthani or Hindi literary historians, or at least part of them. Now, Maru Gurjar is sometimes called Old Gujarati, because its earliest works come from Gujarat, and the earliest work in Maru Gurjar were produced in the second half of the 12th century. It is also called Old Western Rajasthani, and that's the name that many Westerners would be familiar with, because it has been described in detail by a scholar called Tessitore in the second decade of the 20th century. Are basically the same language, but now attributed to Rajasthan. And Jain authors like to call this language Gurjar Jain language, so the Jain language from Gujarat. There is a literary tradition in Maru Gurjar from the second half of the 12th century, and we also possess very early manuscript material from the 14th century onwards of Maru Gurjar literature. It is due to two facts. One is that Jains were very meticulous in preserving their manuscript material. In fact, they have worshipped the manuscripts that contain the sacred knowledge. And secondly, Gujarat and Rajasthan had a climate that was more favorable for the survival of manuscripts than the climate of the Hindi belt further to the east, not to speak about the climate of Bihar and Bengal. In this literature, we find a lot of Jain narratives and stavans, hymns, composed initially in Gujarat, but then from the 14th century, we also see that in the same literary idiom, there are compositions coming up from Rajasthan, and these Marugurjar compositions circulate both in Gujarat and Rajasthan. Which, in fact, even around 1000 of the Common Era, were part of one political unit, the Gurjara Parihara Empire. An interesting thing about the Marugurja literature is that it often mixes vernacular and Apabhramsha features. So they can be sometimes bilingual, that certain certain lines are in Apabhramsha and certain lines are in the vernacular Marugurja. And they have very rich manuscript circulation. And for example, the mid 14th century works from the mid 14th century circulate in manuscripts that are now found in hundreds in Rajasthan and Gujarat. So there has been a very rich manuscript circulation of Marugurjar literature. Now there is one problem with Marugurja that hasn't really been addressed by scholars, and it is still to be addressed, is the transition from Apabhramsha into Marugurja. So it is rather the literary tradition, but that these Jain works are called Marugurja. Normally there would be a couple of linguistic features that are considered to be more vernacular and less Apabhramsha, for example, the loss of case system, and also the simplification of verbal forms. And now, Marugurjar literature, as it spread, it became, again, Sheldon Pollock's term, a cosmopolitan vernacular. That it was produced in Gujarat, then it spread in Rajasthan, and it circulated equally in Rajasthan as Gujarat, but it also spread over the regions of the Hindi belt where Jains were present. So with a substantial Jain presence in places like Erac and Rajgir and in other places, vernacular works were produced within the Hindi belt. An interesting thing is that these works from the Hindi belt are put together by me as works produced in the first 100 years of Hindi literary of vernacular literary production within the Hindi belt. The earliest dated literary work in vernacular that can be localized in the Hindi belt comes from Erach in Madhya Pradesh. MacGregor in his history talked about Erach as an unidentified place, but it is a very important town on the river Betwa in Madhya Pradesh, which controlled a passage on the river, and in ancient times it has even had a mint. And Shailendra Bhandare from the Ashmolean has also worked on coins coming from Erach. In the 14th century, it was part of the of various empires, first of the Delhi Sultanate, then of Jaunpur, and it even had a small spell of independence. Nowadays, Erach is a small village of some 8,000 inhabitants, according to the 2001 census. But this is the place from which we can have the first dated vernacular work within the Hindi belt. After this, so after the Pradyumna Charit, which is 700 couplets, mostly in Marugurjar, and some quatrains called Vastu in a much more Apabhramsha-like language. After this comes Vidhanu's Gyan Panchami, or Siya Panchami, or Suya Panchami Chaupai, which was produced in Rajgir. In 1367. At that time, there has been an important Jain community in Rajgir, so the ancient Rajagriha of Bihar. An interesting development is that both Sadharu's and Vidhanu's language, Vidhanu's works, are produced in the Chaupai or Chaupai meter, which is a moraic meter having 16 moray in each half line, and rhyme each half line rhymes with its other 16 plus 16 rhyming with each other. And this is true about most of these works, that they are produced in the Chaupai meter. And the Chaupai meter and the narrative, writing a narrative in a Chaupai meter, has been emulated by a Sufi called Maulana Daud, who lived in Dalmau and produced his Chandayan in 1379. Dalmau is nowadays again a small place of about 8,000 people, but again an important place on the river Ganges. Jaku Maniyar has produced a datable work from 1396, but only four lines of it are published, and I haven't been able to locate a manuscript. Probably it is with Harihar Nivas Dvivedi in Gwalior, who at one point mentioned that he wanted to publish it, but he died now one or two decades ago, so, and the publication of his material still awaits. The next datable work is Lakhan Seni's Haricharit, again a narrative from 1424 in Jaunpur Chausa. And then we arrive to one of my favorites, who is Vishnudas of Gwalior, so on the borderlands of Madhya Pradesh and Uttar Pradesh, who produced a Pandav Charit in 1435 and Ramayan in 1442, all are in the common era. Vishnudas is considered to be the first poet of Braj Bhasha, and this is how it is Vishnudas is presented in Sheldon Pollock's Language of Gods as the initiator of Braj Bhasha poetry. However, writing in Chaupai or in Doha Chaupai, he is already following a long tradition of producing narratives in this poetic meter. Now, Marugurjar in Madhya Desha, I just wanted to show one of the earliest manuscripts of Pradyumna Charit, which is from 1605 Vikram Samvat, so that would be 1548. Which is far earlier than any manuscript that have so far been presented as Hindi manuscripts. But even though it is 200 years after the production of the Pradyumna Charit. However, the Marugurjar works in Madhya Desha, which share linguistic features with the Marugurjar, can be grouped together. So Sadharu, Vidhanu, and Lakhan Seni all show the same linguistic features in the extant manuscripts. And these linguistic features join them to Marugurjar literature produced in Gujarat and Rajasthan, but not in the Hindi belt. However, narratives from Madhya Desha have been reworked into later idioms. We only possess manuscripts of the Chandayan from the late 16th century, and already the modern editor Shyam Manohar Pandey suspects that this work has been reworked, and also its modern edition has been standardized to the Avadhi of Tulsi Dasa. So its editor, Mata Prasad Gupta, who is also the editor of Tulsi Das and the scholar on Tulsi Das, just updated the language that, on which it has been published and circulated. But it can be also suspected that even the language of the earliest manuscripts have been maybe manipulated with, while there has not been, we cannot detect so much manipulation with the earlier Marugurjar works. So that's Maulana Daud is later to be perceived to be at the fountainhead of Awadhi literature, while the other two people will become part of Braj literature, Jhakhu Maniyar, as far as I can judge from the four lines that are published by him, by Harihar Nivas Dwivedi. He his work looks to be very much like modern Braj Bhasha. And then comes Vishnu Das, whose works again look like modern, meaning Mughal time Braj Bhasha. Here, it is impossible to reconstruct the original linguistic form for both of them. And in Vishnu Das, we find lots of archaisms, and I'm going to talk a bit more about these archaisms. And these archaisms are very close to the Marugurjar forms observed in the other works. Here we are. I just put together the postpositions used for the various cases, and here I'm comparing Vishnu Das's use of language with Marugurjar from Marugurjar's Aitihasik Vyakaran produced by Hari Vallabh Bhayani, and a book called Gurjara Rasavali, which is an edition of 14th century Marugurjar works, with Madhya Deshi, Sadharu's language, Pradyumna Charit, and then I put Vishnu Das's Ramayan here, and then also later usages like Old Marwari, also Daud's Chandayan as preserved in later manuscripts, and the later or Mughal time Braj. No, I'm not going through everything, but I would like to draw your attention to the genitive postposition. In Braj Bhasha it is ko, and those who know modern Hindi can see that it is the equivalent of modern Hindi ka, Hindi sahitya ka itihas, the history of Hindi literature. And in Awadhi also there is a similar form coming from the same root etymologically. However, in Old Marwari and in all the other works, you have another root, and that's tanau, which comes from Sanskrit tanaya, and also is part of an upper branch vocabulary. And what we can see here is that in Madhya Desha, still there is this continuity with the Marugurjar, but the ko also pops up in these works. Now, the language of Vishnu Das became called Gwaliori later, as Vishnu Das operated from Gwalior. It is also stated in his works. And from the 18th century, the name of Gwaliori changed into Braj Bhasha. And this is the name that became the name of the most famous Hindi literary dialects. What has happened was that Vishnu Das's language was updated time to time, and the archaisms, which are preserved in some manuscripts, are already discarded in some other manuscripts. And we can guess that Vishnu Das had much more archaisms, which are close to the Marugurjar forms than in the present manuscripts that we possess from the late 17th century onwards, which are Brajbhasha manuscripts. So here we can see how an early work, probably very close to Marugurjar, has been reworked gradually to Brajbhasha. And now I just want to show an overview of the literary idioms that Apabhramsha has already been considered to be part of Hindi already in the nationalist era, but modern scholarly consensus doesn't accept that. Then there is Marugurjar, which hasn't been very much considered part of Hindi, apart from some Jain Hindi scholars from Rajasthan, like Agarchand Nahta, who talked about Marugurjar works as part of Hindi literature. But it has never become a mainstream Hindi literature, and it would be a bit embarrassing for a Hindi nationalist Hindi literary historiography to acknowledge that Hindi literature comes from outside, from Gujarat, and not from Hindu, the main Hindu group, but rather from the margin, the Jains, as it would be embarrassing to acknowledge that one of the earliest datable Hindi works, Maulana Daud's Chandayan, is produced by a Sufi, again a non-Hindu. So Marugurjar literature has not been very much taken into consideration by Hindi literary historians. However, it has always been part of the Gujarati literary tradition. And what we see is that Marugurjar works were produced in Madhya Desha, and certain works which were very close to Marugurjar have been reworked into later Brajbhasha because they were considered to be part of Brajbhasha tradition. And we can also suspect the same happened to the Avadhi of Maulana Daud, that he was emulating Jain literary forms, also linguistically very close to Marugurjar, and producing a narrative which later became at the, considered to be at the fountainhead of Avadhi literature. There are other literary dialects like Sadukkari, which I mentioned, is much more a hodgepodge of literary dialects, and the Kariboli, which is the literary dialect, which is the dialect on which modern Hindi is based, and it is also a literary idiom from the 16th century onwards in North India, and maybe even earlier from the South. All this, at one point or another, has been considered to channel into what is called nowadays Hindi. Some of them have been acknowledged by historians and some haven't, but when we talk about the development of early Hindi, we should really take into consideration the multiplicity of literary idioms, idioms on which literature can be produced, and quite often it is the literary idioms that dominate the choice of language and not the regional dialect within which I work. And here I would like to mention a parallel, and that's Italian literature. Italian literature can be perceived in a way that in the first millennium mostly Latin literature was produced, and from the early 13th century works in Italian pop up. However, earlier to this, or almost a century earlier, there was literature, vernacular literature, produced in Italy, not in any, based on any dialect in Italy, but the dialect of Provence, Provençal. And the troubadours of Provençal became I trovatori in Italy. So again, a literary idiom has been exported and was used as a vernacular in a larger area. So That's what I wanted to talk about within the framework of Hindi literary history. Now, the question remains open, where to imagine the beginnings of Hindi. But this question reverts back to what we consider Hindi. Whether we side with the nationalists taking in Upper Bransha, or with the Jain scholars saying that the Marugurjar literature is also part of Hindi, or with some of our contemporary scholars who would discard all the earlier stuff and start with works that have become part of later Hindi literary traditions. So in this way, Sheldon Pollock is right to point Vishnu Das as the Adikavi of Hindi, because he has been reworked into Brajbhasha, and he is the earliest influential Hindi poet to be reworked into Brajbhasha, into a surviving literary tradition. The same about Awadhi and Maulana Daud, as Alison Bush suggested, that it is prior to Vishnu Das, but Chandayan is at the fountain head of Awadhi literature. Or was Hindi really created in the 19th century? The question remains open, and probably there will be a lot of discussion about this, but I wanted to draw the attention to Marugurjar literature, which has long been neglected in Hindi literary history. So thanks for your attention.
Thank you.